Welcome to Challenging Climate, a podcast where we discuss the science, technology, and politics of climate change. I'm Pete Irvin, a climate scientist.
And I'm Jesse Reynolds, an environmental policy expert. Each episode, we bring on a guest with a unique perspective and deep expertise on climate change and put challenging questions to them.
In this episode, we spoke with Dr. Elaine de Kooning, Professor of Socio-Technical Innovation and Climate Change at Eindhoven University of Technology and an Associate Professor in Innovation Studies and Sustainability at Radboud University.
We covered a lot of ground in this episode. One theme, particularly at the beginning, is the science-policy interface, how scientists and scientific knowledge can best inform policymakers. In particular, Elaine has been active in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and we touch on why it remains relevant after all these years. Elaine is also a member of the new Climate Advisory Council of the Netherlands, as is Professor Linda Steg, who we had as a guest on episode 24. And finally, towards the end of the episode, something that I found particularly interesting is our conversation around the different challenges and opportunities concerning behavioral change versus the potential of new technologies.
Yeah, and we get into the challenge of decarbonization. We sort of open it up a little bit, thinking about what's involved, not just in decarbonizing electricity, but all of the sectors of the economy. Talked with her a bit about some of the preconditions for the transition, which in developing nations involves quite a lot of human capital development and education, as well as institutional capacity building, which I found quite interesting. We also talked quite a bit about some of the differences between the developed and developing world, some of the tensions there as well, talking specifically about some of the differences between the UK and Netherlands and Indonesia, which I found really interesting. We also talk a little bit about what makes for a just transition and how some of the different strands of justice pull us in different directions. And before touching on some of our favorite subjects of CDR and SRM at the end and some of the challenges that these bring.
Before we go on to our episode, just a quick reminder that this podcast is produced by Jillian Chong. Please help us cover her and other costs by supporting us at patreon.com/challengingclimate. That is patreon.com/challengingclimate. And now we bring you Dr. Elaine de Kooning. Our guest today on Challenging Climate is Elaine de Kooning. Elaine, welcome to Challenging Climate.
Thank you.
Let's begin, as we typically do, with a word about your background. How did you end up where you are professionally?
Yeah, so I'm a chemist by background, atmospheric chemist. But over the past 20 years or so, I became more of a social scientist and transition and innovation studies researcher. And the process there was that I was working on atmospheric chemistry and was really fascinated by the climate change problem. But I was actually engaged in a conversation with a then well-known Dutch climate skeptic. And in corresponding with him, giving him, you know, scientific papers, trying to really tell him, okay, this is what the science says. Why are you still claiming what you're claiming? He was completely insensitive to that. And that just, for me, that made me realize that it's actually not that much scientific data that are convincing people. If they don't want to be convinced, they will not be convinced. So it's actually what I'm doing here in my lab, looking at the reaction of HNO3 on Saharan dust in the higher troposphere. Is that going to make the difference? So I decided to move more into sort of policy research and worked for a long time at a research institute, the ECM, Energy Research Center of the Netherlands, and then afterwards in academia. In parallel, I've also worked on several IPCC reports. I was really lucky to be involved in the technical support units, especially for the special report on carbon dioxide capture and storage, which came out in 2005. So I coordinated that report, which was a super steep learning curve, but very, very interesting because you really get a view of how it works, this science policy interface at the international level. And then later on, as an author, I became more involved in these IPCC reports, which is a super fascinating process.
Specifically on the IPCC, that's of course been in the news lately. Synthesis report, the final volume of its major sixth assessment report, was released just earlier this month, in fact. And you've had a number of roles in the IPCC. You mentioned technical support unit, editor on the special report on CCS. I know that you were a coordinating lead author on at least two reports. And I've seen the IPCC recently, not criticized, but questioned. releases reports, and the headlines that end up in the news are not that varied. Climate change is a risk. There must be transitions, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm wondering, given your experience in a number of aspects at the IPCC, whether at the margin, this still remains an effective use of scientists' limited time in terms of advancing the science and informing policy.
Yeah, good question. And many in the IPCC are asking themselves that question, obviously. For governments, the IPCC is tremendously important. I think that cannot be underestimated. Not just the science it brings together, because, of course, IPCC is not advancing scientific understanding. It is synthesizing, assessing the scientific literature. So everything that's in IPCC reports, we, in theory, already knew. The value is in bringing it together. But the other value is in its political approval, is in that the SPM, the Summary for Policymakers, is approved on a line-by-line basis by all governments that are members to IPCC. And, of course, it becomes very political. Basically make politics about science. You put it down in a document, but there's a check there, and that is that the authors are there to make sure that what ends up in the Summary for Policymakers is not inconsistent with the underlying report. It has to be in line with the underlying report. So you have a document that is agreed by every government in the world, and that is about the scientific basis of climate change, including the transitions and what needs to happen if you want to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. And there's, I think, a tremendous political value in that. If we didn't have that, it would be much harder to make decisions in the UNFCCC. If we hadn't had that, basis for the Paris Agreement wouldn't have been there. So I think that that value is still there. And even if we exceed 1.5 degrees, and even if climate change becomes worse, which I don't hope, and I think we're sort of heading towards better solutions, then still, you know, these assessments make sense, because still we will need to make decisions on adaptation and compensation and further mitigation. So I think its value stays. It does have a lot of issues. One of them is the enormous amount of literature. It's, frankly, in the AR6, I was in the mitigation report, has become unmanageable. And you cannot assess anymore. So the reports explode in size. And even when we're trying to limit it, in a way, way too much information. And also, these huge assessment reports every couple of years, every 7 years or so, it's maybe, you could say, not frequently enough. We need more frequent information as a basis for decision making. So there's, and then, of course, in specific fields, there's issues. How do you include social science? Are the integrated assessment models doing what? So a lot to say about the IPCC, but I think across the board, it is still a very useful organization. I feel very honored to be able to contribute to the report and meet so many amazing people and to help governments. And one additional point, maybe, in developed countries, right, we have the access to the scientists. But the governments in developing countries, for them, it's often their only source of information. And that there's a huge value in that as well.
And your work at the Science Policy Interface over the more recent stage of your career, if you will, has been at a number of institutions and locations, of course, the IPCC. But you're also active in the Netherlands policy advice world. And I saw your name recently as a member of a new committee, the Wetenschappelijk Klimaatraad. So that's the Scientific Climate Council. Can you tell me a little bit about what that new body is, what it will do with respect to climate policy in the Netherlands?
Yeah, sure. It's indeed a new body. It's going to advise the Minister for Energy and Climate on his climate policy. It's going to give sort of both solicited and unsolicited advice. It's a very multidisciplinary committee of experts, of academics, really designed to be independent. So even if you work at a governmental research institute, of which we have several, you're not allowed to be on the committee. So even the Royal Meteorological Society or institute is not, employees of that are not allowed on the council. It's that independent. So that makes it different from some other climate change councils. For instance, the one on Iceland is more like there's representatives of business, of NGOs, etc. It's more like a representative body. And this is really supposed to be independent, so really a scientific council. So yeah, what we'll do, we will start work on 15th of April. The first thing on the agenda is Dutch government has to make a climate plan in 2024 for the next 5 years. So our first advice, which is a solicited advice, will be about that. And what the unsolicited advice will be, we'll have to see. I mean, we have to discuss it with the committee. It will build on work of another expert committee, which is ending its work in just 2 weeks. It's an expert committee that gives an outlook on the energy system in 2050 in the Netherlands. So it's really trying to see what could it look like and what is our vision and how should the government act on that? Because so far, the Dutch government has been mainly focusing its climate policy on 2030. Has very ambitious targets, 60% emission reductions compared to 1990. Has not been able to achieve those targets. It doesn't look like they will achieve it. They have to do extra measures. But they haven't really been looking beyond 2030. And in order to be climate neutral in 2050, which is the European climate law and also the Dutch climate law, you have to be CO2 neutral well before that, right? So 2040 or so. And we're not really prepared for that. We barely know what the country will look like in 20 years when we have to be CO2 neutral. So that's still a big question mark. And that's what this expert committee is about. So I think the expert committee will end its work and then the Climate Council will sort of take over, will broaden its assignment. It will include adaptation and also the agricultural sector. And I think it will be fairly comparable to the UK Climate Change Committee in terms of its role, keeping the government on its feet on climate policy.
Great. So I wanted to dig in a bit what it will take to decarbonize the world. And I think, you know, when most people in developed countries think about this, they think of solar panels and wind turbines, flying less and eating less meat. But there's quite a lot more to it than that. And yeah, I think I noticed the IPCC 1.5 Celsius report framed this around four transitions, which I thought might be quite nice to reflect on. And this is the energy system transition, the land and ecosystem transition, urban infrastructure transition, and the industrial system transition, these four. But I think they're going to look quite different depending on where you are. So in the UK, the Netherlands, it's going to look quite different from developing countries. And when I think about the challenge of decarbonization, my mind always turns to, say, Indonesia. I visited it in 2014, and it's a country that, when I visited, actually, in 2014, just overtook the UK in terms of CO2 emissions. So the UK was sort of slowly coming down, and Indonesia is rocketing up. You know, it's the fourth largest population in the world. 17th largest economy, split across many islands. It's a complicated place. And
largest exporter of coal in the world.
Largest exporter of coal in the world.
Yeah, it's a super complicated country. I think make a really good point, right? Every country has its own story. I mean, even between the UK and the Netherlands, even though they're in many ways very similar. But Indonesia is a great example. It's basically, I mean, you're in Jakarta, huh? You see the streets filled with cars. I mean, they talk about the weather, not about the weather, but about the traffic, right? It's about as unpredictable as Dutch weather. There's a rising middle class, which is buying stuff, household appliances, etc. And in Indonesia, everything is imported. There's almost no manufacturing. So there's a trade balance issue. And how is the trade balance sort of balanced? By exporting coal, biomass, you know, palm oil, etc. So their economic stability and the rise in welfare of their, especially their middle class, really depends on exporting climate change, basically. So there's a huge issue there. This can only be repaired if Indonesia itself develops an economy around the good stuff and not just around the bad stuff. And that requires local manufacturing, local products, local added value. And that requires education, well-educated people who are able to run these factories and to work there and to build up their own economy. And that's why also in this 1.5 degrees report, we identify these enabling conditions that can help set off these system transitions. And one of them is institutional capacity. And it's probably the least talked about, but a really important one, because that's in many places, especially in developing countries, but also in developed countries, actually. But the gap is way, way bigger in developing countries is the issue. Is the lack of supply of people who know what, who are educated enough to really run also a low carbon economy and have economic benefits out of growth in low carbon ways. And everybody in Indonesia is sort of acknowledging this point that the institutional capacity is too low to make that happen. It's a barrier to progress at the moment, even though it's such a rich country in terms of resources and even consumption, you know, even markets. So that's a huge challenge. Again, you know, it's different in Botswana, it's different in South Africa, and it's different in Brazil again, right? So and that's why in every country there has to be that capacity.
Does this require sort of self-sufficiency? Does Botswana need to have its own endogenous wind turbine factories? Because, I mean, I guess if someone's going to produce them cheaper somewhere else, what's the vision for, you know, if you've got to import all this technology, all this equipment to realize this transition?
Botswana, of course, yeah, that's a country of 3 million people. Indonesia is, what is it now, almost 300 million, right? You would expect that. Country like that, you know, that would have a manufacturing base. And also now, right, it's very diverse around the world, which country is producing what based on competitive and comparative advantages and all kinds of other factors. So that will not be different. But if the situation is, and we also highlight that actually in the mitigation AR6 report, the situation basically remains that low carbon technologies are produced and manufactured only in either developed countries or a couple of large developing countries, in particular China. That means that all the other countries have to import that technology and will not get a lot of economic benefits out of that, including job creation at different levels, and will not have a lot of industrial development along with that. That creates new foreign dependencies. And what we see now is that a country like Argentina is exporting more raw resources, including more lithium, with all kinds of environmental and social consequences, but is not really benefiting from technological development as much. It's basically getting the environmental impacts, but not the economic benefits.
I guess if I'm listening to presumably Dutch policymakers, but also UK policymakers that are arguing for a green transition, it's precisely because we can dominate these markets by getting in early and becoming the wind turbine powers of the future to export the technology around the world. I guess it is in the interests of developed nations to dominate these markets and sell it around the world. Can that square be circled?
That's a very good question. I haven't run the economic models on that, and I don't think anybody has actually to this detail, maybe except for a modeling group in Exeter, which has sort of the simulation models. But every country likes to present itself as the potential technology winner so that they can invest in it. But not everybody will be, right? You know that. When you do industrial politics, you know it might fail. So it is still important to have that rhetoric of everybody trying to be a technology winner so that investments are made. Sure, some will be disappointed. Capacity will have been built. There will be some benefits to all kinds of different places in the world. And there's not always one winner, right? I mean, it doesn't need to be one country that produces the technology for the rest of the world. It's not the situation right now. And I hope it will not be the situation in the future. So not everybody can win everything. You're absolutely right. So in that sense, that cannot square the circle. But I do think it's part of the rhetoric that can move us forward as a sort of an international community. Although I do really feel that we should not rely on technology alone, and that's not the only game in town. There's much more to the changes we need than just technology.
So coming back to those sort of four areas of transition, the energy system, the land and ecosystem, urban and infrastructure, and the industrial system. I mean, as far as I'm aware, there's really good progress happening on the energy system side of things. You know, wind and solar are really taking off. But how are we doing on those other dimensions? How does progress look if you scan across those different areas we need to be working on?
Yeah, it depends on the area, geographical areas, of course. And just to explain, those four transitions are, we have those four because we tried in chapter four in the 1.5 degrees report to combine adaptation and mitigation in one chapter. So normally you have in mitigation, you have the mitigation sectors like mobility and built environment, et cetera. And these are a little bit like them, but in the adaptation world, right, infrastructure is a huge thing, water infrastructure, urban resilience, et cetera. And that's why this is a separate one, which then includes mobility and built environment. So that's why these are a bit unusual from a mitigation perspective. But yeah, you're right. I think in electricity in particular, not even in all energy, progress has been very promising and still not going fast enough, but it's going faster than I would have predicted 10 years ago. And many people, I don't think anybody really expected this type of fast cost reductions, particularly. I mean, in mobility, we're also seeing a lot of advance, especially on the technological field in electric vehicles. But in terms of the system change of different mobility systems, the progress of, you know, online meetings is impressive, but that's obviously taking care of need for contact and communication. But on the other hand, I mean, we still see a car dominance. We do not really have a system transition in terms of stopping the growth of individual personal vehicle transportation and moving more to, you know, collective and non-motorized means of transportation. I think industry, we're seeing developments, but if you take sort of material circularity into account, I think progress has been very limited. And that is sort of needed to make a sustainable industry happen, also to make a carbon neutral industry happen. So that's the start, but an awareness, but it's challenging. And land and ecosystem, including our food systems, it's not my field of expertise. It's again, very, very scattered, where meat and dairy production is a huge climate issue. It's also a huge adaptation challenge. And we're making baby steps, I think, but we're not seeing a system change around the world yet. So there's still a lot to be done, despite, you know, the promising developments in electricity.
So you said in your public lectures, your core motivation for working on climate change is the injustice of it. You know, the fact that some are much more responsible for causing climate change than others. And typically those who are going to see the worst effects of climate change are those least responsible for it. What makes a just response to climate change? What would be the tests to apply?
Yeah, there's really smart people who've thought a lot about this. So reproduce what they've been finding. And also we've written some of that in this expert panel that I on the energy system in the Netherlands. We've sort of defining justice in that and really saying, well, this should be one of the bases of your policy. And we're distinguishing in that, I think it was 6 elements of a just transition or of justice. 2 of them you already know, like international solidarity, right? So what you do here, one country should not have justice implications in other places. And intergenerational, which is, of course, for climate change, a very clear one. And then in terms of just transition, everybody knows about the cost and benefits, right? And that they should be equally distributed or at least fairly distributed. And this goes further than only costs, right? It's also about jobs, but it could also be about, for instance, identity. If a coal mine gets closed somewhere, that affects the well-being of people in the sense that they identify with this coal mine. It's their bread and butter. It's what their grandparents did. And you see very emotional responses. You really take something away from people by closing a coal mine, even though it's better for their health and even for their economies, etc. So that's a loss as well. So that's all in this distributional justice. And then there's procedural justice, so that all voices are heard and interests are taken into account. Due process is followed and that the procedures are fair. And finally, what they call sort of restorative or recognitional justice. And that has to do with injustices from the past. But if you know, if you go into a transition and you start at a certain moment in time, you're not starting from scratch, right? There's a past. And some groups may have felt injustices in the past. And if then, you know, for instance, wind turbines are built right outside their houses or something, and they've already been, you know, next to a highway and a transmission line, that happened in Amsterdam North. But some of the policymakers were saying, oh, these people, right, they already live next to the transmission line and the highway. So it doesn't matter if they get these wind turbines as well, right? The view is ruined anyway. But these people were saying, but we are already living next to a transmission line and a highway. Why always us? Some other people can look at these wind turbines. Yeah, so you try to restore some injustice from the past in your just transition. That's also an element of just transition. So I think just applying these kinds of criteria to any kind of policy decisions would be useful to be aware of the implications, the justice implications you are having when you're making decisions.
I guess one strand you didn't mention there that comes to mind for some people is retribution. The aspect that those who caused the problem ought to be punished for it. Is there a tension here? Because I think there is a role that fossil fuel companies could play in the transition. Perhaps their technology could be used for carbon capture and storage or for geothermal. Is that more important or is punishing the wrongdoing more important? How does that sort of factor in?
Yeah, that's good. I never thought of it that way. There's some work by Sonia Klinsky in Arizona State University, and she looked at peace and reconciliation processes as models for dealing with climate change and acting together on climate change. And for instance, looking at the peace and reconciliation in South Africa and how if you start a process like that, right, you need to be in a very difficult place together. Basically, there's nobody sees a way forward anymore if not this problem is handled. And then you have to sort of acknowledge injustices of the past. But retribution actually is not so much part of that. It's more like acknowledging that this has happened, that this has been bad, that we need to move on together somehow, that we start basically from a common starting point together. And the retribution is more in acknowledging that something has been wrong in the past, but not so much then using that to make the future happen.
So I guess another question here is there a bit of a trade-off potentially between a rapid transition and a just transition? I mean, I think the example you just raised of the, you know, this community north of Amsterdam, right? If you just plow ahead, you know, bang the infrastructure in as quick as you can, local opposition doesn't matter because we've got this greater cause to be served. Is there a tension here?
Yes and no. I think there is a tension in the short term because you want to move on with the transition and just put those wind turbines there and then they're there and we can move on. But I think in the long run, you're undermining your support. And you need that support. You need it really bad to make these transitions happen. And with every project that you push through, some people lose trust in the decision makers on this process. So in the long run, your transitions will be delayed. I mean, so many countries in the Netherlands, many renewable energy projects have been delayed because of public resistance, including also carbon capture and storage projects. I mean, you name it, renovation projects. making houses energy efficient, etc. And with every project that doesn't run well like that, the government is or other actors and trusted a little bit less. And next time, the basic attitude towards these projects will be one of mistrust. And that is a terrible basis to start from and a basis that will take years and years to repair. So I think it seems like it's taking longer, but in the end, you can move faster with support than without support.
I want to shift gears here one step from transitions to the related area of technology. This is a topic where your work at the Science Policy Interface has focused, in particular, a coordinating lead author of a chapter in the recent assessment report on innovation, technology, development, and transfer. And your title includes socio-technical innovation. You're a professor of socio-technical innovation and climate change. And obviously, innovation and new technologies are essential for the transition to a sustainable, net zero, safe climate future. But you've also been skeptical of reliance upon technology in general. Earlier in our conversation, you've said something like we should not just rely on technology alone. And you've been particularly critical of some technologies as being distractions or techno fixes or whatnot. I'm curious, what sort of criteria do you use when you approach a technology thinking about, is this potentially appropriate or is this a risk of reliance or distraction or unwanted secondary effects, be they environmental or socio-political, economic?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole field called technology assessments that deals with these questions. And they tend to apply criteria on environmental impacts and social impacts, etc. And so that's all well known, and we should definitely do that. And many governments require this. I think what those kinds of assessments tend to not take on board so much is the broader context and the more systemic aspects of technological innovation and implementing technologies, chain effects, impacts in other places of different technologies, right? If you look at electric vehicles, it's a good example, right? We tend to look at the air pollution and they produce, it's great, but at the same time, you know, elsewhere, mines are destroying people's lives and livelihoods. So first of all, you know, make that assessment really broad. That is one thing, and then see whether it's still actually the desirable outcome. And then there's a next level, and I think carbon dioxide capture and storage is a really good example of that. Is technology actually, you know, indeed a dangerous distraction, or is it really helping us reduce emissions very quickly? And how can you deal with that? And it's also dynamic over time, right? When we wrote this special report on CCS, the IPCC report in 2005, it was seen as something you do on coal-fired power plants. There's a very limited section in there on industry. And in the meantime, renewable energy came up, and actually we have much better alternatives now for coal-fired power plants. So, I mean, you can still retrofit maybe some CCS on some, but it's basically mainly on industry, maybe for negative emissions. So the technology also has a different role in the climate change debates over time. In the Netherlands, for instance, now we're really not only looking at the application in industry only, but we're also talking about capping its use so that it's not replacing other technologies that might be more sustainable in the longer run. And we're looking at sort of an exit strategy, so a date by when you shouldn't use it anymore, acknowledging that it's probably the only technology that can reduce emissions in the industry very quickly, like before 2030. But at the same time, acknowledging that it's also maybe dangerously locking us into a fossil system. So they're trying to balance that with policy responses. But the first step is to acknowledge that it is maybe not a technology that you want to use. And then I really tend to say that there's no technology that doesn't operate in a social context. There's always societal issues around it. And even those people who think, no, for my technology, this is absolutely not the case. It is always the case. Even the engineers that work on it are still humans, right? So they make decisions. So taking that into account and doing something with that and acknowledging that and not seeing technology only as technology, as the hardware, is very important in moving things forward. And then automatically you start seeing it as part of a system and you evaluate that way. I mean, for me, it's in the Netherlands, we have 8 million cars at the moment, on a population of 17 million people. For me, a sustainable mobility system does not mean that we're replacing those 8 million cars with 8 million electric cars. Right, it's maybe halving the amount of cars and doing the rest with other means of transport is a more sustainable and desirable place to live in. But that vision will differ for different people. So you need to have a conversation on that. And only then do you really know the role of your technology in your system transition. And yeah, I think the conclusion is we cannot innovate ourselves out of climate change. We need much broader changes in different places.
I'm glad you brought up your work with CCS, carbon capture and storage, and you hinted at where that conversation in a way has shifted in more recent years, and that's around carbon dioxide removal, removing carbon dioxide from the ambient air, not just from the exhaust of a fossil fuel burning facility. And many of these more industrial methods, like direct air capture, would look like CCS. It would grab the air just from the ambient air. Other methods are more biological, basically using organisms in one way or another to get carbon into the ground. And we're at a point now with emissions where the accumulated carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and projections of future emissions are so great that nearly all scenarios that limit warming to 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius typically rely on large-scale carbon dioxide removal in the future. And this has been the target of some criticism, saying, well, it's a major hidden assumption to just sort of say, well, in the future, I'm going to pay off my credit card debt is one way to look at it, right? We're in debt. We're in carbon debt as a world. We've overspent our budget. And this might just be kicking the can down the road, relying on technologies that it's unclear whether they can scale up to that degree. CDR exists, but can it exist at multi-gigaton per year scale? What's been your reaction to this criticism? I mean, you were involved in the 1.5 special report from the IPCC where that was a key issue. Do you think there's some merit to those criticisms, that we need to be real careful about the hidden assumptions in the more optimistic models?
Yeah, and they're actually not that hidden. And I mean, if you look at the graphs of 4 illustrative scenarios, for instance, in the 1.5 degrees report, pretty clear that it's using a lot of CDR in some of these pathways, right? Like 20 gigatons per year by 2080 or something, which is half the current positive emissions, right? It's almost unimaginable. And actually, in the 1.5 degrees report, there's in chapter 2, there's great assessment modeling is done, which results in these types of models for some pathways. And of course, in a way, it's a little bit of a model artifact, right? Because these models tend to kick the can down the road, right? That's in their optimization algorithm, that's sort of optimal outcome. So that's what they choose. You can do something about that. And that resulted in some scenarios that, for instance, are stronger on behavioral change and reduce their emissions earlier and then don't need as much carbon dioxide removal. In chapter 4, in the chapter that I was in, we did a more broader assessment, more bottom-up assessment of carbon dioxide removal options. And was including sort of a potential assessment in 2015, like how much gigatons. And actually, it's sort of challenging some of these pathways, right? So if you will, there's a bit of an inconsistency in the report, but it's not an inconsistency. It's just two different methods giving a different result. And that's why in the summary for policymakers, you read that we have to be very careful about carbon dioxide removal, that we need a combination of options, that we need basically all of India in terms of surface area. If we want to reach those bioenergy and CCS numbers that are in some of these higher CDR pathways. So I think there's a lot of qualification around CDR, which you also mentioned. And I think there's a lot of merit in that. And also, we did an assessment on the feasibility of carbon dioxide removal options, 5 different options. We found a lot of gaps in literature. Just there's no information, or the feasibility is still very low in terms of economic or technological maturity or social cultural feasibility. In that sense, I think it was a report that showed that we cannot limit warming to 1.5 degrees anymore without carbon dioxide removal. But at the same time, saying the earlier you reduce your emissions, the better, essentially, because every ton of CO2 that you emit a year longer, you have to remove, and the potentials are limited. The impacts are large. And as you say, we should not squander budgets, which we have to make up for later.
Global warming is currently at about 1.1 degrees Celsius relative to pre-industrial conditions. And some unknown amount of warming is, in fact, masked by low altitude air pollution. This might be 0.1 degrees. It might be as high as 0.5. And as we clean up low-level air pollution to save lives, the planet will warm, and we don't know by how much. So there's a chance that 1.5 is already built into the climate system. And even if not, the prospect for staying within 1.5 is reducing. The probability is reducing. The IPCC, in a press release, called it almost inevitable that 1.5 will be crossed And in the most recent synthesis report, it says, well, if we follow the most aggressive emissions reduction pathway, the 1.9 RCP, then even then, more likely than not, 1.5 will be crossed. And around the same time, less noticed, the UN Environment Program released a report on solar radiation modification, sometimes called solar geoengineering, the prospect of countering climate change by artificially cooling the planet. And this report said that SRM, as it's typically abbreviated, is the only way to rapidly cool the planet, the only way to rapidly counter climate change, because CDR and emissions reduction, as well as adaptation to reduce impacts, are quite slow processes. Is it time to take SRM more seriously as an additional backup means to reduce the worst effects of climate change?
I think this is a really tough question. I think there is still hope that we can limit climate change. Maybe we will exceed 1.5 degrees, but by the end of the century that we under it again. And we should make every effort to get there. And I know that in the SRM community, everybody's sort of advocating that it needs to be on the agenda. Is saying, well, it should never be a replacement of mitigation. And I think that is really hard to make that claim, because it will always be, you know, there will be resources going there. That's one thing. There will be smart minds spending time on that, including powerful people who are, you know, fascinated by new technologies and who are quite influential. You know, it might be tempting to look more into that and forget about the more mundane work, like, you know, insulating houses and changing behavior, which we never seriously tried, if I'm very frank. So it's a really tough one. I wish we wouldn't have this conversation, frankly. But the reality is that we are, and that people are viewing SRM in this way. And also the reality is, as this UN report also said, it is the only option that can quickly cool. And so if you would need to do that, the argument goes, you know, you better have this card up your sleeve so you can play it. There's one issue with that, and that is that technology tends to not work that way. The technology is not something that you keep on your sleeve. When you need it, you pull it off and you apply it, right? And we just talked about how technology always operates in a social context. The same will go for SRM. It doesn't work that way. You have to sort of use it and try it out and get accustomed to it. And then when you apply it, you start thinking, oh, maybe the rules I had initially devised don't really work. So I have to revise the rules. Maybe adjust legislation, maybe make new agreements. So, you know, this sort of picture that is painted, like we will, you know, just use it when the shit really hits the fan and then all will be well. And I think that is unrealistic and potentially very harmful, because we also know that in geoengineered world, the world that uses SRM, it's not the same as the world where you didn't use the SRM. You will not return to the same climate, right? Even when you cool the temperature, it will be modified. And well, I mean, you had many podcasts about what the governance implications are and et cetera, how difficult it is to attribute certain weather changes to, et cetera. But I think the genie has left the bottle, I'm afraid, on SRM. We will keep on talking about it, really hoping that we can keep the conversation as limited as possible and that it will be minor distraction from mitigation, which we need so badly.
Yeah, we should say we both work on the topic of solar geoengineering. We are very distracted by solar geoengineering already. It's fully distracted me from working on climate change in another way. But I guess we've got two challenges with climate change. One is cutting emissions, making the transition, and the other is coping with the impacts of climate change. And I think these challenges look quite different depending where you are in the world, which is more important, which is more your responsibility. And I think, you know, in developed nations, it really is our responsibility to get a move on. We are not acting quickly enough. But in the developing world, it looks quite different. You know, they're on the receiving end of climate change, and this might have the potential to greatly reduce the risk of climate change. I think I agree with you that this certainly will be a distraction from emissions cuts. But how much of a distraction can we get away with? In the sense that, you know, if this delayed emissions cuts by 20%, but reduced climate impacts by 50%, would that be okay? Or is it more important to just get on with emissions cuts? It's not an easy answer.
Yeah, and shouldn't be an or question. I mean, what I understand of SRM is also that we have great difficulty knowing the impacts of it. If you have a large-scale intervention, which will not be like 2-year exercise, right? If you really want to cool the Earth by 0.2 degrees or something, and sort of peak shave or however you want to call it, you will have to do this for a couple of decades. and you will have to keep it up, right? Because of termination shock, et cetera. So I think those kinds of risks of not being able to keep it up, we don't really know what stratospheric aerosol injection over 30 years does to the stratosphere. I understand there's some modeling done that what it does with hydrological systems in the boundary layer in the troposphere. So there's so many unknowns that you're sketching a scenario that we know the impact, but I don't think we do. And I'm not sure if we ever will before we actually use it, if we will. Yeah, that's worry that I have. And at the same time, of course, I see the temptation of using it, especially if you're in a country that is very vulnerable to climate change. And yeah, it's not that expensive actually to do it. It looks like the best thing to do in your own interest. And that's precisely the situation that we've gotten ourselves into.
So looking a little nearer term, what gives you hope in the coming years in the fight against climate change? Or are you optimistic about where we'll be in the next few years?
Yeah, I think, I mean, if you work on climate change and you're an optimist, you're not very realistic, I think. But that doesn't mean that you have to be a pessimist, because that's also not very productive, I think. So I do tend to be hopeful. I mean, there's so much happening at the moment. And at the same time, we haven't really seriously tried many things. There's not been like a, you know, a really serious effort in behavioral change, for instance. I sometimes say that we would have invested 1% of everything we have invested in nuclear fusion in changing people's behaviors. We could have gone way really far, I think, with nudging and really changing things. What I take hope out of is you have these system transitions, and in the IPCC report, we identify these enabling conditions, institutional capacity, innovation, behavior change, financial system change, policy, and governance. And I think these can reinforce each other. So if you have a behavioral change, it can lead to different governance structures, which can lead to financial system change and innovation, and maybe reinforced with policy, this can actually lead to a much more rapid transition than we would have anticipated, when the only option you have is a subsidy or a carbon price. So I think there's much more that we can do in order to understand the system dynamics, maybe the social tipping points, and how we can intervene there on an individual country basis or even a regional basis, and really speed things up. And I do hope that there's more possible there. So my hope is in that we haven't really seriously tried. And it can be done. I think it can go way faster than the integrated assessment models are telling us. And there's evidence for that as well. The big challenge is how do we connect the dots and how do we build the institutions to make it happen?
Well, that is an optimistic note. And thanks for joining us, Helene. That was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for listening. Please rate or review us on Apple Podcasts and elsewhere, and consider supporting us on Patreon. That's patreon.com/challengingclimate.